Hello and welcome to Profiles on WFIU. I'm Peter Noble-Kachera. The video game industry is now $6 billion, rivaling the size of the entire film industry. Hollywood has tried again and again to capitalize on that in a series of game-related films, but many of these have been critical and box office failures. Today we'll be speaking with David and Scott Hillenbrand, the producer-directors of a new film, Gamebox 1.0, available on DVD. The film perhaps comes the closest we've yet seen to capturing on film the actual experience of gaming. Speaking to us from Los Angeles, David, Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
You don't have to tell us how old you are, but how close are you two guys in age?
We're 2 years apart.
Were you interested in movies when you were kids growing up in Long Island, or did that come much later?
No, we were always interested in movie making. In fact, we performance and theater and all the arts. We actually had a magic show business when we were kids growing up. David was an accomplished magician, and I was his bumbling assistant.
Is that an older brother, younger brother kind of thing?
It is. Our dad wrote the show for us, and that was the part that he wrote for me. And since I wasn't the magician, I did stupid magic, and David did all the accomplished.
It was a little things. Back and forth, comedy type, serious magic as well as comedic magic,
and we did pretty well at kids' birthday parties all through junior high school and high school.
It was a good way to earn a little extra cash as a kid.
You know, when you went to high school, which I think was at the Performing Arts in New York, did you ever make movies together? Any little movies?
Essentially, through school, we were both involved in drama, all the plays of the school. We didn't really experiment as much. We didn't have, like, an 8mm camera film. We certainly, as video cameras got more and more sophisticated, we started playing around. But we kind of had a straight path where we focused more on drama.
And theater. And, we went to see a lot of Broadway shows, and that was our medium for really learning about drama.
And going to the movies, and loved movies. We were in the generation that was, as far as influential from the start, Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jaws, that type of time period where fantastical and science fiction and played a big part in our excitement and introduction to the movie experience.
That was also a great period for video game movies too. The 80s, there were a lot of them coming out at that time.
Right. I mean, Tron was really a very groundbreaking movie ahead of its time. It was a little more on the cerebral side, but very interesting the way they explored that idea. And in some ways, we compare Gamebox 1.0 to a modern-day Tron, really, where we're getting a sense of the video games of today, the Grand Theft Autos, Halo, Doom, those type of games, and the experience that those games have created is the world we wanted to explore in Gamebox 1.0.
And certainly the experience of game playing has changed from, the time when we were growing up to, where the games and the level of the sophistication and why the games have gone where they've gone is certainly an interesting topic to talk about.
I want to talk about that at some length later. I'm interested now specifically in your paths diverged. You went to different schools. Scott, you went to Northwestern, and David, you went to Indiana University for your undergrad and then USC for your grad. And how did you come together then professionally?
Well, we always wanted to work together, from the beginning as kids. I went back to New York to do some, Broadway-type, plays and work in the theater in New York. David was finishing up his graduate work here at USC. And it was only a matter of time until we said, okay, now it's time to come back together. And in 1991, we formed our company. And we wound up doing a stage show out here in Los Angeles as our first production, which won a couple of Critics' Choice Awards. And that was the beginning of Hillenbrand Entertainment.
And then we made our first movie. It's a story that you've heard before, though I think ours was slightly unique how we did it. We made our first movie on 45 credit cards. The sheer number of credit cards was about $240,000, where we just kept applying for more and more credit cards and each amassed a certain amount, and then we cashed them all out in a course of maybe 2 or 3 days. We went around town with fanny packs, maxing out every single credit card.
Because at each bank, they would only allow you to do 2 or 3 cards at like $5,000 a pop. So, you know, there used to be a billboard on the way to the LAX airport by American Express that said, use your card. You can even make a movie.
Yeah,
see one or make one. So we said, great. You know what? The signs are telling us that we should be making a movie.
So we cashed out the cards, put all the cash in the bank, and made our first movie, which was a film called Hostile Takeover. The original title was Sharpen the Saw. That was our filming title, which is a business term in Stephen Covey's Habits.
Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. But all the distributors felt that, that was beyond the public. It became Sharpen the Saw to Hostile Takeover.
Right. Sharpen the Saw felt or sounded like a horror movie to them, and it's really a corporate thriller. That's
where we began. We went down to Florida. We filmed the movie in our dad's law office at night when nobody was there, and filmed in people's houses, friends' houses, and how we made our first movie. And it led to the second, third, fourth, and you know we keep going.
Did you have any kind of a guarantee or at all that this movie was going to get picked up for distribution, or was this just a total gamble?
Total gamble. You know, we just went on our instinct saying, like, we believe that we could tell a story cinematically and put it together. And we made it with no distribution. And then we showed it around and got worldwide distribution for it. It was actually one of the
in 1995,
one of the video business's best picks of the year of independent films. So we were pretty happy about that.
Honored. And it was at a time in our life where we sort of skipped a small period there as far as us coming back together again after school, after I finished USC and Scott went back to New York after Northwestern and was doing theater.
You were doing music on movies, right? Is that right?
Right. My experience at USC was for film scoring. Scoring for motion picture film and television, a very prestigious, exciting program there run by some of the top industry professionals at USC. It was a wonderful experience, as was my experience at IU. Both were very, very important and fantastic experiences to my understanding and growth in film, television, and music. And after that, while Scott was doing the theater in New York, I started working for a number of different companies out here in Los Angeles, gaining experience in film and television and music for film and television. I worked on the Power Rangers show and X-Men cartoon and a bunch of different things. And then Scott came out to California, and we did a few things together besides the play. We also worked on a show that went back to Broadway called Bugs Bunny on Broadway, which was a live show where they projected the classic Bugs Bunny cartoons with a live orchestra playing the Carl Stalling original scores in sync to the picture. It's still a show that tours around the world even to this day. It was very successful, and it's a very fun, enjoyable show. We kind of then picked and learned what we felt worked well at other companies and how they put together productions, and then things that we felt we could do perhaps better or more our way.
It's a case of writing what you know, which is what they tell you to do. Well, let's start talking about Gamebox. You had made a couple of films that were very special effects heavy. Piñata Survival Island and King Cobra both had hundreds of special effects shots. Was that a good preparation for Gamebox 1.0?
Well, it was interesting because King Cobra was our second movie, and that relied mainly on practical special effects, animatronics, and physical effects, things we did live on the set. It was at a time where CGI, computer-generated imagery, was gaining more and more. More shots were being done, but it was still relatively new, and we wanted to, with that film, create sort of like a Jaws experience where it was really there on the set, the actors could really respond. Our budget was limited as well, and we were happy with what we achieved there. When we got to Piñata, which was then made in 2002, is that right? Or 2001?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. We got more into the computer-generated effects.
And the price, you know, the sheer ability to go out and buy the workstations, which is what we chose to do instead of using a conventional, effects house, we decided to create our own garage band special effects division. We bought all the equipment and we hired 12 guys, set them up in our office. They helped us design the software and the render farm and everything. And that was really the transition and the leap off.
And the mixture of animatronics
and CGI. That was I think, the best training ground for going, hey, you know what? We could actually pull off a movie like Game Box, which two-thirds of the movie was shot in front of a green screen. It was we laugh about it because we shot Game Box, all the live shooting of it, in 12 days, and then it took us like 2 years to finish all the CGI, working with a team of like 10 to 12 guys, just by the sheer number of shots that needed to be done to pull off Game Box.
Well, you know, the cheap, fast, good triangle, you know, pick two, yes. Cheap, fast, and good. I mean, obviously, yeah, right. When you don't have the, you know, infinite resources of budget, you're going to have to take the time, and you figured out a way to do that. Was there a pre-existing script that came across your desk? Is that how you came upon the project?
No, Game Box was our idea, and it was something that we had started writing together, actually, in between, I think, Piñata and our movie Dorm Days, National Lampoon's Dorm Days, and it was something...
We got like 60, 70 pages of it down, and we were really liking the story.
And then we put it aside. We actually, as you just described, the script, it was called a college sex comedy, came across our desk. Scott actually met a couple of young guys at a video store fresh out of college themselves here in Los Angeles, who said they had a bunch of scripts, which happens a lot, and asked if we would be interested to read them. And we did, and we found the script that became Dorm Days. And so we put Game Box aside for the moment just as we went on to make Dorm Days 1.
And everything happens for a reason, and timing, and what was happening in the video game industry. I think that if we had finished and completed Game Box 2 or 3, 4 years earlier, it wouldn't be having the same impact that we see that it is having now that it's coming out right now.
And even just the experience with those guys who wrote that script, a college sex comedy, we had a very good experience with them from that point forward. So what we did, and their names are Worm Miller and Patrick Casey, is we gave them all the work, all the research, and the 60 or 70 pages that we had written, and we hired them to finish it off and reimagine it for, again, the trick with Game Box. We knew it was going to take time in post-production. We didn't know exactly how long, as you say, with the triangle to achieve what we wanted to achieve, but we had to project forward enough for the time we were shooting and essentially at first writing the story, then shooting it, then doing all the effects, and where video games were going to be at the end. And it's interesting because the movie today, and we wanted to be just ahead of the technology, and so we had done a lot of research. There was a phenomenon at the time of an online game going around that was creating a bit of a stir. It was almost like a gag game where you could input the image of your boss, and it was like kill your boss or shoot your boss. It got a lot of publicity for obvious reasons, the idea of running around and shooting or killing your boss and what that meant for society, and was this a positive outlet or is it scary? And that idea of taking the likeness of characters in your life and them, you know, that likeness then being utilized in the game, we liked that idea, and we talked to a bunch of game companies that were developing, you know, at the forefront of what games were doing, whether or not that was going to be in the future, was that going to be possible? And it's funny because even right now, a lot of the systems are still dabbling with that idea.
Where you can take your image and put it as the lead character, so when you're watching the character go through the game, you're essentially living out your own fantasy. And we think that's a very interesting concept, and it kind of goes back to the whole Wizard of Oz thing of, you know, all the images, the relationships that you have in your real life, and how that can transfer into a game world, which is really at the core of what's going on in Game Box. You talk about triangles, and we think that, you know, we worked very hard to create two triangles. Charlie, the lead character, his girlfriend, you know, Kate, gets shot before the movie starts while they're in high school by a cop on drugs. And
she was his soulmate, his what he believes, and you kind of get the sense, his one and only truest love.
And he has been unable to move on. And then he's given this game that comes from who knows where, and he has to pick his friends in the game and create some characters.
It gives this little camera attachment and tells him he must choose the characters to play the characters
and then,
in the game.
Right, and then he has to choose a villain, and so he winds up choosing the cop who was actually, you know, let off for, you know, what he did wrong, and makes him the villain, and then thinks about shooting, taking a picture of his girlfriend, the dead girlfriend, and making, but he's like, nah, that could be too painful. And then the game actually takes that image out of his head.
And he's surprised in the game when he discovers her as the princess in the first game he begins playing of Crime Spree, which is kind of a Grand Theft Auto type world, a modern urban game where he's supposed to rescue someone who's being held hostage,
and he has to figure out what his mission is all along the way. So we took the triangle that caused him the tragedy in his real life and put that same triangle in the game. So while it's techie, it still has a very human quality of...
Because he's completely thrilled and excited to see his girlfriend alive again. And what's interesting is she doesn't know who he is, or she doesn't know who she is to him. And it's this sort of back and forth kind of relationship, almost like a Han Solo Princess Leia, where they're at each other's throats partially as she slowly discovers who she represents, who she is, and gains her own understanding of what Charlie has been through and who Kate is or was and what that relationship was like. And it's sort of he falls in love all over again and she to him, and it's got a lot of...
And then we've taken the characters, you know, the friends, and they wind up showing up in the game in different characters just to facilitate Charlie's journey within the game through the different game world.
And there is a moment where Charlie winds up shooting a goon, basically, in this first world, Crime Spree, who looks just like his friend Peter. And he's a little taken aback as he sees him lying on the ground, dying, and he asks the game specifically, "Game, can you turn off the faces that I captured?" And the game answers, "No, all the settings are closed." So he clearly, in that moment, embodies a little bit of what that backlash was about, of like, wait a minute,
I'm a little uncomfortable with this actually killing my friends,
right,
and seeing them die.
Even though I only know it's a likeness, that's got to be, especially if you're in the game and it looks completely real, that's got to be a very weird, scary thing.
Which is kind of an interesting thing that we did with the movie is, you know, like you had said at the beginning of our talk today, that there have been a lot of movies of made of video games. What we wanted to do was sort of make a movie that was dealing with video games, you know, kind of going the opposite direction. Not a direct translation of video game to movie, but a movie that actually would birth a video game.
And a movie that kind of spoke to the experience of playing video games, the idea of you have a certain amount of lives. You have to find out, like, the difference between the video games of the past and where they're at today, as you know, is you have free will, free choice. You could go anywhere, do anything. You have a certain goal, certain missions to get to different levels, but you have the ability to pick and choose your destiny within the game. And we wanted to explore those concepts, the idea of how many lives you have, the idea of health icons. If you get injured and wounded, you could regain your health, your strength. The idea of sort of a repeat mode where if you die, if you lose a life, you get knocked back a little bit in the game to where you were just previously. And then you have to figure out perhaps what to do a little differently in order to get past that obstacle. These were all ideas that we wanted to, you know, hit head on in a game, in a movie, so that the audience, it feels like they're watching a movie, but they're also feeling like they're playing a video game.
Well, I can tell you, as a lifelong gamer, that's what I appreciated probably the most about the movie, was that it really did sort of dig down into video game logic and kind of capture that experience. I want to take just a minute and listen to a clip from your movie, and this will illustrate the idea about taking pictures of your friends and bringing that into the game. Do you want to set up the clip for us?
Sure.
Yeah, it's the first time Charlie's going to play the game. So he gets this game box, this GameCube kind of unit.
He doesn't know where it came from.
And he doesn't know what it's going to do. When he puts the headset on, it sort of activates the game, and he hears these voices. Are they really happening in the world that he's in his apartment, or is he imagining them in his head?
Is it pre-recorded? Somehow it seems to be speaking to him, and it tells him what he needs to do. But he's freaked out and intrigued at the same time.
Let's go ahead and listen to the clip now.
Hello, Charlie. Welcome to Gamebox 1.0. You've been selected to be one of the first beta testers for the Ultimate Gaming Experience, which uses the newest technology to customize the ultimate game for you.
Hmm.
Before you begin, you'll need to capture images of real people to play the characters in the game. You'll note a small camera attachment included in the box. The camera will process your selected images and automatically download them into the system.
This is too weird. Hello?
Hey, Charlie. It's Kaplan.
What's up, Kaplan?
Hey, did you get this weird new system in the mail?
Yeah, you got one too?
Yeah, I just played around a bit, man. It is amazing. This thing's gonna be huge.
I wasn't sure if I was even gonna try it. Seems like a lot of preliminary work.
Dude, it is totally worth it. Trust me, bro.
Okay, thanks. See you later.
Bye.
Where'd you come from?
Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, Charlie.
What's up, man? Check out my dad's new big screen, huh?
Hey, Charlie, this is Michelle. Michelle, this is Charlie.
Hi.
Hi. Do you mind if I take your picture?
For what?
It's kind of hard to explain. It's for a video game.
No, I look terrible.
Just let him take your picture, dude.
That's all right. John, say cheese.
Dude, is that a camera?
I think so.
But you said it's for a new game system?
Yeah, it's supposed to take pictures of people with this thing. Not sure how close I need to be. One of the other guys at work got it too, so I guess it's a promotional thing.
Where is it?
I didn't bring it. I just stopped by to take a picture.
Wait, you're not staying?
I don't know.
Come on, we never see you anymore, you ass.
Yeah, you need to be more social, man.
This is social? Maybe Charlie has something better to do.
Oh, yeah.
I should really go test this thing out. See you guys later.
Hey, man, you're really leaving?
I'll hang out later.
Tomorrow. We'll have a barbecue.
Yeah, dude, just come over.
Yeah. Okay.
Wait, pause it. Hey. You promise?
Tomorrow. I'll be there.
He's kind of weird, huh?
He's just depressed, but you never told her about Charlie?
She never met him.
What?
His girlfriend got shot.
She died?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, that was a clip from the new film Gamebox 1.0. We're speaking with the film's co-producer, directors, brothers David and Scott Hillenbrand. In the clip we just heard, these are 20-somethings and they're still living at home. And is this a social criticism of Generation Y?
Peter, you're right on the money, and thank you for saying that, because it's actually a very funny scene to us, because
if you take it on a certain level.
Well, because, you know, Charlie comes in and the kids, the 20-year-olds are all excited about their father's new big screen TV and how great it is. Them, and it's kind of a little, to us, weird. It's like, okay, well, you're really proud of your parents' achievements, but really, when is the time where you're going to be moving out of the house and creating your own achievements?
And in fact, there's a moment where, you know, they're sort of mad or angry at their friend Charlie there for not hanging out with them, not joining them, and that he's not social anymore. And the one girl who's sitting there, who's a girlfriend of one of the guys, there's three guys, his friends, who are playing the games, and the girlfriend looks up from her magazine and she says, "This is social."
Do you think video games are a social activity, and it's speaking generally?
Well, I think it is, and as they are there together playing a game. But again, the movie keeps exploring the idea of, is it better to sit and play baseball on a video game screen, or football, or even, you know, something more active? Or is it, are people still today getting outside and throwing a baseball? Are they kicking a soccer ball? Are they playing?
I think the experience, like where David's going with that, is the experience of playing a video game is, while it can be social if you're all playing a game together, it's you're still in your own world. You're interacting with the controller. It's not like you're interacting physically or really. I mean, I guess you can be talking, but most of the time when people are playing video games, they're so focused on what's going on in the screen with their characters that it's a different kind of social.
You know, I think also, like many things in life, taken in moderation or at a certain amount, there's certainly healthy experience playing video games. They're fun, they're exciting, they contribute to eye-hand coordination and stimulation. I think the the tricky thing with video games and where there's been a lot of social commentary on it is it can be very addicting, like gambling, where you sit for hours and hours and you're not going outside and throwing a baseball. You're overweight. You're not getting exercise. You're not seeing the sunlight. You're sitting in. Now, there's also the phenomenon of online games. And there's a quote that a friend of ours had said, which we've sort of adopted here. And it's kind of a scary line that we repeat, which is people today are more concerned or interested about their standing in the virtual world than they are in the real world.
Well, I think that's kind of alarming. And the main reason that troubles me, and again, just full disclosure, I'm a lifelong gamer, is that if you're living primarily for a virtual world, the real world can be falling apart around you and you don't really know or care.
There was a story, Peter, that was I think it happened in the Orient. I'm not sure if it was Japan or China, about a kid, and this is when we were filming Gamebox, where there was a kid who was playing video games and he was so obsessed with them.
Yeah, I read about that.
Okay, and then he wound up jumping out of the window. So, you know, you're looking for the correlation of, like, well, how did that happen? You know, so it kind of goes into the social commentary that you were talking about.
And as you saw, the movie opens with a little bit of a preamble with a character that we don't know anything about. He's in the middle of playing this game, and it seems life or death. You're not sure, is he having a dream? Is he playing a game? What's going on? But he's running for his life, literally, and then he winds up, as you'll see in the movie, not too good. That experience of the story in the Far East there, the Asian country, that Scott mentioned.
It kind of scared us.
Yeah.
It scared us a little bit. We knew we were onto something, at least with what we're trying to say.
Well, it's very interesting how you handle that. The character of Charlie in the game is played by Nate Richard, and he starts out as a slightly doughy, kind of geeky guy. He's a video game tester all day long, and then he goes home, and all he does is play games. And, I mean, this guy has absolutely no life, but when he's in the game, he's very vibrant, he's very lean, and his hair looks better. And, you know, I wonder if that's some of the attraction of games, is that, you know, we can be who we're not.
Well, it's also, you know, one thing you'll see in the movie, which we try to do, exactly how you explain Charlie in the real world. We meet Kate only one time. We hear her voice in flashback, but we really see Kate for the first time before she was killed in a home video that Charlie plays at his house, that you get the feeling he watches it over and over. But not only is that the one moment where you get a sense of Kate and her personality, but you also see a younger Charlie. Was it 2 years ago or 1 year prior, before she was killed? And even there, he looks happier. He looks more vibrant. He looks more, his hair is better, all those kind of things there. And so for him, there's a few things going on. One, like you talked about, of the idea of a character who's not really living life. All they're doing is playing games, and they're kind of schlubby, doughy, and not...
He's a walking zombie.
Right,
because he's not interacting with the world.
He hasn't moved on. His friends, his coworkers, you know, are trying to get him to come out with them and socialize, and he doesn't want to do anything except play the video games and relive his past.
Because he can be in control, because he's so good at playing games, he can be in control of his own destiny, and I think that control is comforting to him, where the world, things got out of control, and he feels very uncomfortable. So that's why when he goes into the game world, he's cool, his hair is good.
But not in what we wanted to do there is not make it just a two-dimensional, hey, now I'm a cool video game guy. It's sort of like, yes, he's now the hero of the game, but he could be that, he can look that way in real life. He could be that vibrant, that excited, and it's the journey of the movie, as you've seen, and the people listening, if they watch the movie, they'll see that it, in some ways, though the video game is scary and death, there's got, you know, real world implications that are very scary. In some ways, for Charlie, it winds up or has the potential to be cathartic, or for him to learn something. There's almost a gift feeling in it as well of like moving on.
The game tells him again and again, the game is not a punishment; it's a challenge.
Right.
Correct, which is really what life is. You can look at life and just, you know, focus on the hardships and the tragedies of life, but that's a universal thing that we all deal with.
It's a challenge to move on.
Right, it's how we deal with that and, you know, try to make the best out of our world.
Well, let me ask you, talking about how Charlie looks in the game, this sort of brings up the subject of the film's look. I was thinking about this, and all the way from the beginning of films, back with, you know, Melies and Voyage to the Moon and Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and you mentioned The Wizard of Oz. Directors have had to figure out ways to put a real person into a fantasy landscape. And now we're seeing that in modern films like crazy with Lord of the Rings and the Star Wars prequels and 300. They're spending staggering amounts of money to figure out an approach to doing this. So you, with less money, how did you figure out a unique way to go about that?
Well, let's break it down into a couple of categories. The first thing we wanted to do was work with the makeup, because CG characters and in CG world, we've seen over and over again where you just take an actor, you put him in front of a green screen, and then you put him into a digital world. We wanted to make the actor look like a CG character. In other words, what's happened in video games is they've worked very hard to make them like movies. So the way they move, there's a slight stutter, the way the characters look in the video games, their skin is smooth. So
the camera angles
so
as well.
The thing with the makeup is we did a lot of tests to try to almost like carve out on the actor's face the symmetricalness and the geometric shapes by outlining the forehead and, you know, using certain kinds of shading to make their skin look somewhat plastic.
Because in the video games, as you know, the challenge and goal is always more detail, more and more detail, more realness, more resolution, and yet, obviously, even today and to the best looking games, there's got to be certain simplicity in the face, in the skin, in the texture. You don't see follicles as much or sweat or hair. So we tried to smooth that out a bit with the makeup and make it more block, more angular, less detail, yet with the goal of a video game trying to have more detail, we took reality and tried to simplify it slightly to hopefully meet in the middle.
So also with the wardrobe, like Charlie's, simple pair of pants, simple lines on his red shirt. Again,
not a lot of patterns or things that look like they were chosen to have a lot of detail, and yet they don't have it. It's a weird thing because you're working from two opposite ends and hopefully meeting in the middle to create what seems like a very, very sophisticated game, almost real, and yet from our standpoint as filmmakers, taking something that is real, a real actor, a real person, and simplifying them slightly both in their movements, which Nate Richard and Daniel Fischel did a fantastic job.
Because if you go back and you watch the movie several times, you'll notice that their fluidity in the real world and then the way they move in the game world is slightly stuttery.
Slightly. Again, trying to be video characters who are trying to be real. And they get better and better, but again, trying to. So that was one thing
the
makeup. Then we did extensive tests, and the interesting thing for us again was we wanted it to look like a video game, not a movie. We shot with different types of cameras, all the real world
stuff. In the video game, you actually have some scenes which are shot from familiar video game camera positions, such as a first person shooter or a high angle shot.
Correct.
So angles was another way. We wanted for certain scenes to try and shoot them, as you say, from those basic type game angles of first-person shooter, high angle. We also used some camera rigging, a camera company by the name of Doggy Cam that makes certain rigs that you see a lot in music videos. The particular one that we used is a harness that attaches to the actor or actress and allows the camera to be either in front and looking at the actor or from behind and sort of over their head or shoulder like a first-person type shooter. And what's interesting about, because it's locked to the character's movements, it gives a very video game-like feel because the environment changes as the actor stays rock solid, both looking. And there were limitations to using the rigging, so we didn't use it everywhere, but there were certain key sequences and key moments that we wanted to, again,
give you the flavor of what it was, what the gaming experience would be like. The second thing we did with the look of the film is we used two different kinds of cameras. We used the high-definition camera for all the real-world sequences,
which was a Panavision Sony F950, which was and still is the workhorse of the high-def movies like Star Wars, etc.
And then we used a Panasonic DVX-100A, which is a DV resolution camera that shoots at 24 frames per second, so it has a filmic look. And the reason we chose to use that camera is because we wanted the central imagery in the game of the characters to be slightly degraded and grainy. So the quality needed to be a little bit lower, because often you see, you know, pristine images of actors shot in front of a green screen, and then if the world is different, it doesn't integrate in a way that if for us was close to what a video game looks like.
And take that makeup effect and sort of not dumb it down, but smooth it out in a way that we felt integrated. And you'll notice that there's imperfections all throughout there. There's edges that disappear. There's pixelizations that happen. Again, even with the best video games, you find moments or keys that they're really real, and then you make a sudden movement with your character or the environment changes, and a little imperfection or a glitch shows up for the split second where you lose an edge or a moment. And again, we went full on for that, and it was a choice. We feel a bold choice where people can either like it or not like what we did, but we wanted to make a conscious, bold statement with that to have it look more like a video game and a little less like a perfect movie.
Right.
Well, I liked it. I thought it was an original look, and I have a kind of a non sequitur for you. I really wondered about this. The love interest in the game, Princess, played by Danielle Fischel, is revealed at one point in the game to have a certain tattoo on her back, and we learn about it in a certain way, but not by the way that I thought would have been obvious, which would have been a sex scene, and then you could have talked about video game sex. And did that ever come up? Was that ever discussed, doing a scene like that?
Yeah, I don't think we've ever been asked that question, so we're going to have to think for a second.
I mean, obviously, the rating of the film being PG-13, we wanted to cast as wide a net as we could, in that gamers, as you know, start out very young these days.
I have seven, eight. David has a 9-year-old daughter.
A daughter who absolutely loves Gamebox and all the initial screenings of it as well, and really picks up on every little thing that's in the movie and you'd be amazed at. Now, obviously, we could have dabbled with sex and sexual, you know, scenes in a way that still would have qualified for PG-13. But the way the relationship evolves and develops, the fact that she doesn't know who she is to him, and she grows to know who she is to him. There's an attraction. There's a chemistry. There is a Han Solo, Princess Leia spark that they have that didn't really seem to take the story into bed in a way.
These games, the reason the appeal is they're urban, they're gritty. You can get prostitutes, you know. And again, there's another backlash to, you know, parents looking, going, wait a second, do I want my kids being able to make these kinds of choices in games?
As we mentioned, there was a brief craze of video game movies in the 80s when Hollywood was trying to cash in on the prominence of arcades. Tron, War Games, The Last Starfighter are three that came off the top of my mind. And now the arcades are gone, but games are more popular than ever. And again, Hollywood is trying to get in on the games bandwagon, but so many of them haven't worked. I mean, Resident Evil, some people like, but I think it didn't work. And Doom, Tomb Raider, Silent Hill, and a movie that superficially resembles yours from last year, which was just god-awful, Stay Alive. So Why is it that if games are becoming more cinematic, movies about games are generally failures?
Well, as Scott said earlier, what it seems like Hollywood has done in all those examples is they've taken the popularity of an existing game and tried to take that narrative, and have succeeded on certain levels and for certain audience members well, and for others not. They've taken the narrative and then just made a movie based on that narrative,
with
based
those,
on that game.
Right, with those characters and somewhat of those situations. We agree with you. We wanted to take a completely different approach because, you know, if you're trying to really adapt a video game, then you should make it feel like a video game, which is the reason we did Gamebox the way
and
we did it.
You absolutely, I think, nailed some of the video game tropes that I'm familiar with from my own playing, the floating hearts that give you health and arrows that point to your next objective, and you hold up your hand and the game has been storing your weapons and it puts a gun in your hand. I also really liked the voice of the game, which is sort of this unreliable guide for Charlie. It reminded me of HAL in 2001 a little bit. Did you think of that?
Yeah, we did think of that. You know, often there are choices on what really is scary. And, you know, we toyed around, should the game voice be very aggressive?
But Should it be male? Should it be female?
We went through all these thought processes. And in the end, we decided to go, and it's a very interesting story. The voice is actually the sound designer who did the sound effects for the movie.
He's always been a very good imitator and has an interesting voice. And as we were working together on the sound effects, we both sort of turned to each other at one point and said, you know, I
think Ron Silaisis would be the perfect, that's his name, would be the perfect guy to do this voice, because he's able to do sort of this androgynous, slightly feminine but then slightly male quality that you're not quite sure, which is, it's almost like, you know, the actor John Malkovich when he does certain performances, the quietness of his performance and the subtlety of his performances, like in the movie In the Line of Fire, it's very unnerving the way he does it.
As opposed to yelling and screaming without raising your voice, but that intensity or intention could. And so, again, like you said, is the game his friend? Is the game giving him valuable information?
I would like to hear the voice of the game now. We've got another clip prepared, and this one takes place after the zombie attack in Zombieland, and you'll hear the voice of the game throughout this clip. Can you set the clip up a little bit?
Sure. It begins, I'm not sure exactly where it starts.
We're coming out of Zombieland, and then they're going to go into the cabin. And Charlie's learning about the princess, and then there's an interesting thing that happens, that Charlie's friend Peter enters the game. And why don't you play the clip, and then we can talk about it.
Let's stop in there.
What?
I'm gonna chop through that chain.
Are you crazy?
Why shouldn't I?
What if you hit the case? It could kill us.
What is it, a bomb?
No one is allowed to open the case. No one except the professor.
Oh, come on. It doesn't actually matter. None of this is happening, princess. We're in a freaking game.
This isn't a game, Charlie.
Wrong. It is a game. It's a simulation. You, me, this hatchet, and your precious evil briefcase. Look, maybe you don't have the ability to understand. This is all fake.
What?
I'm in a game. You're just a character. The game made you look like someone who was very important to me.
I'm not a character. This is real life.
Zombies aren't real. How do I heal my own wounds? How do I pull a gun out of nowhere? How do I know you love horses, but every time you tried to ride one, you chickened out at the last minute because you said the horse didn't seem nice?
I don't know. No. It is my job to protect this case. I don't want it removed from me. I need to deliver this to the professor.
How the hell can I convince you?
Charlie, I found you. They're coming. Charlie, it's me, Peter. Peter, your friend? Kate?
Oh, how convenient. This guy knows this Kate too? One of your teammates?
No. He's not real either. The game is trying to trick me. I'm the only one playing.
No, Charlie, I'm playing too.
Oh, yeah? How's that, Pete?
Charlie, I gotta tell you something.
Thing is, you're in a coma.
The police found you unconscious in an alley. You've been in the hospital for 2 days now.
That wouldn't explain how you got here.
I went to your apartment. The super let me in after I told him you were in the hospital. I saw the new game, so I put on the headset, and here I am.
How could you possibly have found me?
Well, you know that game voice that talks to you? I asked if it knew why you were in a coma, and it said yes. So I asked it to explain, then it asked me if I wanted to see you. I said yes, and the next thing I knew, I was in this jungle or wherever the hell we are. Dude, what's going on, Charlie? I cut my arm on a tree out there running from the zombies, and it hurts real bad. Dude, we gotta get out of here.
Game, I'm not buying it. Send him away.
Charlie, look, I'm serious. It's me. Hey, who introduced you to Kate, huh? She and I were in the summer musical together, remember?
Of course I do. And everything I remember, the game seems to remember as well. So, no offense if I don't trust you.
Game, tell him it's really me.
This is the real Peter, Charlie.
Look, Charlie.
If you're just joining us now, that clip was from the new film Gamebox 1.0, and we're speaking with the co-producer directors of that film, David and Scott Hillenbrand. The scene we just heard shows us the protagonist Charlie's increasing confusion over what's real and what is an illusion created by the game. There's a line of dialogue in Gamebox 1.0 that I wanted to ask you about. Somebody references David Cronenberg's film Existenz. Have you guys seen that film?
Yes. Yes, it was something that the writers in that scene in the office, they mentioned Videodrome, Existenz, and movies that have familiar themes and familiar ideas played around with. It's one of those kind of layered lines, as obviously you picked up on, and I think a lot of our audience will as well. They could have been any movies. They just want to get Charlie to go out to go see a movie, but and these are video game testers who are talking about this, and it's, you know.
So it's a very insular world.
They would have.
They all live in.
Games people know that movie, and the reason I'm bringing it up is because that movie, more than most others that I've seen, sort of gets at the anxiety that's at the base of a lot of gaming, which is the dislocation between gaming and real life, which is that the characters in Existenz, and also somewhat in your movie, have this little bit of a freak out where they don't really know where they are. Charlie goes back to the real world, but he keeps ghosting on the game. And do you think video games have this sort of effect on people, which is to dislocate you from reality in some way?
Well, I love the warning and information you've seen around about not playing video games on large screen televisions, that the experience and stimulation can be overwhelming to the point where you could pass out and faint. So why is that? Is it just the colors and the movement? I don't think so, because movies, if you're sitting back watching a movie on a big screen TV, can be just as visceral or intense or an MTV video. So what is it? I think
your mind is going into the mind of the characters, and you're living and breathing through the moments with those characters, where to some degree even the best movies you get hooked into them, but you're still
sort of a passive
experiencing it,
right?
Yeah.
And the video game, like Scott said, you're thinking, you're connecting, you're controlling, you are putting yourself into the video game, and I think that speaks to the phenomenon or the danger of the stimulation or overstimulation.
And, right. Is it real? Is it not real? And what, you know, the clip that we just played, you know, one of the most important parts of that sequence is when Peter comes in, and we did a couple of things in the sound mixing of the movie to kind of confuse you a little bit as to whether or not Charlie's friend Peter is real or not.
Because he tells them, as you heard in the clip, that he says to Charlie that he found that he's really Peter, just like Charlie. He's really in the game.
He went into his
apartment and he put on the game and he's playing. But Charlie doesn't believe him. He doesn't know what to believe. As
right.
you mentioned before, it's in the real world, you're playing a video game and you go to sleep and you start dreaming that game and it seems really real and
yeah.
it starts permeating your dreams. So that's a level of consciousness or unconsciousness that it's, again, blurring the gap of reality, of what's real or what's not real. And that's what happens to Charlie with hallucinations, et cetera.
Gamers I know who are really heavy users, it's in some cases
users.
All they want to talk. Right, right.
I love that they have
this addictive quality. And again, I know people who really, this is all they think about is games. And so let me ask you this. One of the games that you picked up on in the movie, one of the games we see, is, I think, obviously based on Grand Theft Auto. And this game is an absolute lightning rod. Senators Hillary Clinton and Joseph Lieberman have both pilloried that game. They want government to step in and regulate the industry. And I thought about Columbine, and it came out afterwards in the news that the two boys had been playing the game Doom very heavily. And so there's been a big backlash against games. And let me ask you, do you think playing violent games either A, causes violent behavior, or B, desensitizes you to violence in a certain way?
I think, for me, the second, you know, because there's been a study on this ever since the dawn of movies, of violence in movies, and then whether or not it translates to violence in society. I think your second comment is on target for me, is that, it, you know, if you can go around in a game killing people, beating them up, stealing things from them, it almost seems like that kind of behavior is more readily accessible and, you know, like it's okay.
I mean, it's an age-old question, really, that has actually transcended movies, novels, you know, pulp fiction novels, dime store novels, the dawn of time of entertainment and storytelling, sitting around a campfire telling a scary ghost story or about... And I think all sides are right. I think people can be stimulated by an experience of a movie or, that seems very real, or a video game that's very real, and they can go, if they are disturbed or unable to handle or...
It's an excuse, like it's condoning...
I've always thought that, I mean, throw in my two cents, I've always thought that that was a pretty spurious argument. I mean, certainly nobody has come up with convincing data to prove that watching behavior causes the behavior. But again, you seem to be talking about a scale of moderation, which is that if you overdo it, maybe bad things will happen. And I guess I'd like to ask about kids and video games. I mean, David, you have one child, a nine-year-old daughter?
I do, yes.
Scott, do you have any kids?
I do. I have a 20-year-old, an 18-year-old, two girls, and then I have almost 3-year-old boy-girl twins.
Well, let me ask you about your youngest kids, both of you. Are you letting them play games? Are you going to let them play games? And how are you going to limit it?
Well, my 9-year-old daughter, she I think has a healthy balance. She plays certain games, but she never, I actually to this point have not had to regulate it and say that's enough, no more. She only plays it. She has handheld games, the DS, Nintendo DS, and she takes it in the car, she takes it on trips, but she also reads books, and fortunately I'm lucky, she's not at a point where I've had to step in. She naturally limits or monitors her game playing, both at home on a Nintendo system as well. She's played Xbox, PlayStation, all of them. And I don't have to worry, at least at this point, of her being too addicted with it. But I know lots of parents do struggle with that, as far as, again, like we talked about before, go outside and throw a baseball or a football, get some fresh air,
absolutely.
Run around.
I agree with David, too. I mean, in thinking about my kids as they're growing, I'm not going to create, unless there becomes a problem, a boundary, because I think that, you know, you have to be open to experience everything in the world, and video games are a part of it. It's a form of entertainment, and as long as it's explained in a way, or you monitor in a way to see that somebody's not becoming obsessed with it in a way that's going to lead to them not being able to function in their everyday life.
Mostly we've been talking about quantity of playing, which for me, as a parent, I have two small boys. That's the big one to me, which is screen time. But the other question is content, which is where the lightning rod issue comes in with Grand Theft Auto and the infamous hot coffee mod with that, where you could actually have sex in the game. The Entertainment Software Ratings Board rates the games just as movies are rated by the MPAA. And so Grand Theft Auto has a big M on it, you know. And so my question for you is, should parents be the primary people monitoring the content of the games, or should that be something that society should step in and protect children from, like from cigarettes or pornography or something like that?
Well, I think the ratings help parents. The ratings themselves, and same with movies. When you have an R-rated, you know, the movie theaters, and there was a big crackdown on this as well, where the theaters got stricter themselves about checking ID for kids coming in. Now, of course, there's always ways around it. You hear stories. They buy a ticket for a PG movie and then sneak into the R-rated movie. It happens all the time, that kind of thing. There's only so much you can do. There's only so much government regulation. I think the idea of having ratings myself is the right way to go, where you're giving the information,
and
you're setting
personal
certain boundaries, and then parents can work with that. And but it doesn't become a police state to the point of, which is never going to work anyway.
I agree with David 100%. I mean, we have to maintain personal choice. I mean, it bothers me that at every stoplight there's cameras. Everywhere we go, there's more and more cameras. 1984 is coming true. Everything that's, you know, happened in the world, causing more limitation and boundaries, I think is dangerous. It's very dangerous. And, you know, I agree with David, is, you know, there's a ratings board, they give you the information, and then it comes down to a personal choice on a case-by-case basis that, you
but
know,
stores,
parents should make.
And stores limiting what children can buy. I mean, I think all those things are good. They're going to find it anywhere or anyhow on their own if they have the ability through peers, et cetera. And that, again, it, you know, always the more involved a parent can be to see what their children are doing, what they're doing when they're out of the house as well, is the goal. It's a challenging goal for all parents to know and stay active in their lives of their children, especially as they get older, when they're teenagers, 13, 14, 15, 16. And it's tough. It's very hard, but that's what you have to do. And that's the challenge, as Scott said, to be in their lives, talk with them so that they're exposed to the right things at the right time in their life. There's plenty of time to learn about the world, as we all know, and the good and the bad and the ugly. And
there is evil in the world, there's bad in the world, but there's way more good. If we created a scale and a percentage, and people, you know, often get fixated on how bad things are, you know, everywhere.
I felt that from your movie that it could have ended in damage, and without giving anything away, it doesn't end that way. And, I appreciate that outlook, and I appreciated that in the film. You have a female video game character in your movie. Video games get a lot of criticism because of their portrayals of women, and you chose an actress who is very attractive, but she's also does not have Denise Richards' proportions. And you live in L.A. You would have had no problem going down to the Promenade in Santa Monica and finding someone like that. But instead, you picked someone who looks like a real woman. What do you think about the way that women are portrayed in games, and why are they so often so unrealistic and ridiculous male fantasies in games?
Your statement or your question is also a statement, and we agree with the statement. If games, and there are lots of games where women are just treated as sex objects and their proportions are so out of whack. Now, you know, the male anatomy is also, you know, these big, broad-shouldered, it's sort of the idyllic male, in some ways, or sexual object, female sexual object, male in some ways. Danielle is very real, like you said, and she's beautiful. She has very compassionate eyes. She's not perfect. You're absolutely right. She looks great in the film.
Like you said, we didn't go for, 5'8", model, rail thin, even though Danielle's, like David said, looks beautiful in the film. She's
voluptuous. She's beautiful, but she's also somewhat girl next door. She's sweet. She's caring. She's funny. She's smart. She's articulate. All the things that, and we appreciate you saying that was a conscious choice to create an interesting, smart character,
And I see it very much with my 20-year-old and my 18-year-old, and how much pressure, girls, how much pressure there is out there for girls to look a certain way, the way that we as a society say is beautiful. And that look has changed over, the years from period to period. I think what makes people interesting for us in movies is the things that are imperfect about them. They say that the greatest rugs in the world, Persian rugs, are all made with flaws because nothing should be perfect in the eyes of, God or whatever you want to believe.
Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, always used to say that perfection is unlovable, that, it's a statue. You can't love a statue, it's cold. What is on your plate next? What's the next project?
Well, at the moment, we are in post-production, final editing phase of our movie that is essentially National Lampoon's Dorm Days 3, though we are toying around with the idea of releasing it a little differently than Dorm Days 1 and Dorm Days 2, and perhaps even calling it something new, because it's very different. It's that we shot it in Romania and Transylvania at an 800-year-old castle, and it's kind of Harry Potter or Young Frankenstein meets the Dorm Days What's Up Doc farce world that we created with Dorm Days 1 and Dorm Days 2, which essentially is like a Shakespearean or Moliere farce with 20-year-olds in a dorm.
We encourage you, if you like Game Box, to take a look at these comedies, because they're more intelligent than a lot of the college comedies that have been made, and they seem to have connected with people across the world. So we're finishing editing that, and we're about to announce what our next project's going to be, but what we will tell you is that we are moving into a bigger budget range, theatrical type movies, and we have done an adaptation of a very, very famous classic novel. And if we had to describe the kind of movie it is, think Last of the Mohicans, Braveheart, Pirates of the Caribbean kind of a movie.
A period swashbuckling romantic adventure.
Well, I'm sure that whatever you do with it, it'll be something different from what everybody else is doing. So best of luck with that. David and Scott, thank you so much for being guests on the show today.
Thank you very much for having us. And
it's been a pleasure. It was an enjoyable conversation. We hope the listeners out there have been intrigued to check out Gamebox 1.0.
And we appreciate that your comments about it and all the parallels that you've drawn, because you obviously got very much of what we were trying to accomplish.
Well, I'm happy about that. We've been talking to David and Scott Hillenbrand. Their new film is Gamebox 1.0. You can get it on DVD as either a rental or a purchase. And for Profiles on WFIU Public Radio, this is Peter Noble-Cachera.
The program you just heard was recorded in April of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.